بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Generally, Muslims begin anything with this formula, which is an Arabic formula that the Quran begins with, which is, in the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate. And the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that when we do things in the name of Allah, or God, that it imbues that thing with what the Quran terms barakah. And barakah is...
In fact, there's a film called Barakah.
Barakah is, according to the Islamic tradition, something that that exists everywhere, but yet we don't always have access to it. And as it increases, the experience of it increases. And so, in a sense, it would probably the closest Christian equivalent to it would be grace, the grace of God. What I want to begin with, before I go into Islam, is just to talk about a few other things in order to clear some area to talk about Islam. Thomas Cleary, who is a translator of the Quran, said that one of the difficulties for people in the West is that they're not able to think about thinking about Islam. And what that means is that we have so much historical baggage that we carry with us, that it becomes difficult to think about something that we've already got a lot of assumptions about. And I'll give you an example. The other day I was reading in a newspaper that's published on campus at San Jose State, and there was in the cartoon there was this, it said third world thugs, and underneath it there was a scimitar, which is the sword that's generally associated with the Muslims. This, most people know this story.
Something like that.
And that's an assumption. We say third world thugs, and some Islamic countries might come up, and some Muslim names like Saddam Hussein is a Muslim name. He's a third world thug. Therefore, we're dealing with a Muslim. And so clearing away that stuff is really important before we can even look at something clearly. So what I want to talk about a little bit, and this is not unrelated to Islam, because the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said that wisdom is the lost property of a believer, and wherever he finds it, he has right to it. In other words, the Islamic tradition has never limited itself to the teaching of Islam. But in fact, in any culture that it went to, it began to explore the understanding, the traditions, and the sciences and arts, literature, all of these things of that culture, and oftentimes actually incorporated it into what would become the Islamic ethos. So for instance, when the Arabs, who are a people that prior to Islam had, their culture was basically, very primitive. It was, the Prophet Muhammad was not a Bedouin. He was not somebody, a nomad. He was somebody that actually lived in a city. And it was a fairly substantial city, on the Arabian Peninsula. In fact, it was really the spiritual as well as the economic capital of the Arabian Peninsula. And it's called Mecca. But at the same time, their sophistication would be absolutely primitive compared to what existed, say, at the same time in the Byzantine or the Persian civilizations or cultures. And so the only thing really that they had that was of any cultural significance in retrospect was their poetry, their language. And their poetry was really something extraordinary. And that's basically accepted, not simply by the Arabs, naturally it's their language, so they would appreciate that, but also by people that have looked into it from other cultures, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim. And so they had this extraordinary language, and it had actually reached its pinnacle right before the Prophet Muhammad,
who is born in 570, which is called, and that's Christian year,
which is called the year of the elephant in the Arabian history. And so what happens is that he grows up in this society, and actually I'm going to step back because what I wanted to talk about was about this other thing, which is related to this. And it's what Heidegger, who's a German philosopher,
called throne.
And what thrownness is, according to Heidegger, is that we are born into cultures. And the effect that that will have on us is really something we can't even comprehend. In other words, the fact that I was born in this culture, I was born in the state of Washington, but I grew up in the Bay Area. The fact that I was born into this culture determined certain things for me. One, it determined that I would be raised a Christian, because I was born into a Christian family. Two, it would determine the language that I spoke, which is English, which is not an insignificant fact, because language, how we speak, has a lot to do with how we perceive things. And so the actual, my language is going to affect the way that I see things. And it has to do with the way that I dress, my understanding of relations between male and female, between adult and child, between teacher and student. All of these different things, my culture is going to have a massive impact. And this is what Heidegger called proneness. Now, what he said was that people exist in an undifferentiated state. And what that means is they never question this thing called proneness. In other words, they never look at why I am the way I am. Why am I Christian? Why do I believe what I believe? Why am I Jewish? Why am I Buddhist? Why am I Muslim? Why am I Hindu? They never ask basic questions, like, what does all this mean? And this, he said, was an undifferentiated state. They haven't started to look at how they got to where they got, because we got here, and it's been a long journey to where we are now in Western civilization and in the United States. The fact that, for instance, relativism, which is a dominant philosophy now, whether we know it or not, whether we study philosophy, whether we think about it, is irrelevant. The fact that ideas that actually occurred to people at a certain time in history are going to affect how we think. Nobody 200 years ago would have said, well, that might be true for you, but it's not true for me. And how many times have we heard that? You see, how many times have we heard that relativization of good, of evil? If I choose to be, for instance, 80 years ago, 40 years ago, a homosexual was something, it was an abomination. It was a crime against humanity. It was a sin against God. Now, for a large segment of the population, it's a lifestyle choice. Right? I mean, is that basically... I mean, a lot of people think that. It's a lifestyle choice. Well, that's been a process to get to that point. You see? And there's people now, there's actually an organization of which Allen Ginsberg, who's a very well-known poet, is a member, which is the National Association for Man, Boy, Love, which says that men should be able to sleep with children, because it's against their rights if you don't allow that to happen. Now, this organization actually marched with a banner in Washington during the Gay Parade March and was accepted by the people who organized that march. So that's at the suggestive level now. But who am I or who are you to say that maybe 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, that will be considered a lifestyle alternative? If I want to have sex with my child, then what's to prevent me? You see, so we arrive at things, it's not haphazard. There's a process. And looking at that process, it's like archaeology, trying to dig up and look at what was here before and where did it come from and who built it and what were they like and how is it affecting who we are? You see, so there's an archaeology of knowledge and concepts, philosophies, and religion has an archaeology as well. Trying to understand why do Christians, for instance, believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Because there were many Christians that didn't believe that concept in the first 3 centuries of Christianity. Many. So how did that become the dominant? And what happened to those other Christians? Where did they go? You see. So getting into questioning this thrownness is really important. And everybody has to do it. And what Heidegger said is that at the point that you start doing it, he said you move into what he called after this undifferentiated state, an inauthentic state. Because now you realize, oh my God, I'm this way just because my parents indoctrinated me to all these things and the society socialized me a certain way and all these things happen. And so that begins a process of questioning. Now this oftentimes happens when we travel into other cultures and we're forced to look at why we are the way we are. You see. Now not everybody does that. I was in a post office in Spain, in Granada, and this American, is what they call quote unquote the ugly American, was telling this postman something and he kept saying, no hablo inglés, you know, I don't speak English. And she just kept talking to him in English. And I said, he doesn't speak English and he can't understand what you're saying. And she said, well, why doesn't he speak English? Now that's somebody that's really not thought about things, that they can be in that state. But unfortunately, there's a lot of people in that state. There are a lot of people in that state that don't realize that there's all these things happening out there that don't necessarily jive with what we know or what we think or what we perceive. And so coming up against this is the beginning of coming up against these basic assumptions, these underlying assumptions. Now, unfortunately, Islam, instead of never having really a chance to just be presented as it stands, it's got all of this this stuff that we've thrown on it in the West. For instance, if I say, this is an association game, but if I say Muslim to you, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Muhammad.
Muhammad, what about you?
Yeah,
this doesn't sound gut to me, but
we don't eat pork. Okay, that's a good point.
Let's eat some bacon. There's a fellow named Francis Bacon who had this concept about idols. And it's actually not his concept. But this is getting to what I'm going to get to my subject. Just be patient. The first one he called the idol of the group or the idol of the tribe. And what he said was, is this, that we have all these preconceived ideas that happen from socialization, right, from where we're born. One of them in this culture, for me, I know, and I don't know about you, but for me, Islam, I conjured up images of Crusader rabbit fighting these swarthy, dark Moors, right, and defending the faith because he had a big cross on his chest. And he was fighting these infidels. Or I have this idea of these funny movies that were made in the 40s or something. Or maybe a Lawrence of Arabia. Or another one is, Rudolph Valentino. When an Arab wants a woman, he takes her. Right? That's what Rudolph Valentino said in The Sheik. Right? I mean, it was silent film, so it came up. So a lot of these ideas that we have, you can see the change that went through because originally the Arabs were romanticized, the males, and the females were seen as kind of chattel walking around in I Dream of Jeannie outfits that were really there for the pleasure of the men in this
harem, right? And so a lot of these things come up when people start thinking about Islam or the Muslim world or what these things, and these things prevent us from getting to Islam. Because one, they're distortions that obviously must have some basis in something. I mean, they just, stereotypes don't come out of nowhere, right? Stereotypes, you see, I meet three or four Hindus, and if I have the same experience, I might even do it from one, depending on what type of person I am. If I have some experience, that is how I'm going to look at Hindus. I mean, people do this all the time. And so, questioning this idol of the group, and the more idols we have, the more difficult it is for us to perceive truth. And idols aren't simply wooden things that people bow down to. And idols can be in the mind as well. See, we all have our idols. We all have these things that they're sacred to us, or we really don't want to, we want to appease these idols and not to upset them. The next idol that he said was called the idol of idiosyncrasy. And that idol, he said, was your own individual nature. Now, some people, we all know the half full, half empty cup thing. Some people look at the cup half full. Some people look at it half empty. Those are completely different ways of looking at the same thing. So those are idiosyncratic idols. Those are idols of the individual. So you move from the group then to the individual. The idols that we all carry around and the way we look at things. And then the next one he said was the idol of the marketplace. Right? And the idol of the marketplace has to do with language and how we perceive things. Now, if you look just at, like right now I'm speaking to you, and what's happening is breath is coming, it's interacting with my vocal cords that tighten and expand and create intonation. Well, that move, that turns into sound waves from a thought that's in my heart or in my mind, however way you want to look at it, idiosyncratically. These move out, and then what happens is they reach our ears. But what happens then is that they actually transform into neurochemical information that moves to the brain, and then the brain has to deal with it. So there's all these interfaces before we can get, before I can say what I want, and before you can understand what I'm saying, look at all these different things that have to happen, this process. Well, along that process, there can be a lot of misinformation, misunderstanding, all of these things that happen to people when they try to communicate. And that's what happens in the marketplace. You said this. No, I didn't. Right? And you get into those things. Or, that's not what I understood. I thought you meant, no, what I meant is, and that's human transaction. Right? And then the last one he calls the idols of fear, which are really interesting. And those are models of how we view reality. Now, you can say from a from one point of view, Islam is a model. Religion is a model, right? Theater.
Theater.
Theater. That's what my I have a English friend. We're from California, so we say water. And he'd say, you mean watcher? Right? Which is idol of the marketplace, right? Where were we? Yeah, after that. We were somewhere.
Yeah.
Model.
What they call, now, this is a good word if you don't know it. The more you go into education, the more important it seems to get,
is a paradigm or a model. And what happens is we have these paradigms or models of thought, and they get turned upside down every once in a while. And so you have somebody like Plato who creates this whole model of looking at reality. And then he has a student named Aristotle who says, you got it all wrong. and he creates another model. And if it's more convincing, people adopt that model. Or if it's more suitable for their what their needs are. Might not be truer, but it might be more suitable. And so what religion does is, and the interesting thing about these things is they don't go away. Mythology doesn't go away, right? I mean, there's hospitals all over this country that don't have a 13th floor. There's a lot of buildings that don't have a 13th floor. You go from 12 to 14, and how you do that, I don't know. But you do it because people have this, what we would term, if we're rational, an irrational fear of the number 13. Where does that come from? Well, it's the devil's number. Who said so? I mean, Jesus had 12 disciples, and he's number 13 in them, right? So, you know, we need to question things. Right? And just ask, how valid are they? And how rational or irrational are we being? And is rationality the best thing at all times? And so what happens with what religion does, and religion, I would really appreciate if you didn't even think when we say religion, God. Right? That's a word associated. Religion, God. Religion, the sacred. Religion, divine. Religion has to do, it comes from a Latin word which means to bind. Religio, to bind together. It's a way that, it's something that creates group cohesiveness. It's a way of looking at things that we can all share, and that allows for the society to be able to function without kind of disintegrating. Because if everybody starts thinking whatever they want, doing whatever they want, you see, if somebody doesn't want to socialize with everybody and urinates out in the hall, not only is it going to be unpleasant, it'll be smelly as well. And so there are certain things that function to kind of keep society together, cohesive. And religion is the paradigm that does that, you see. Now, science is a religion for a lot of people because it has all of the elements of religion. Religion is about belief. It's about conviction. If I believe that man was descended from apes, or that there's this natural selection going on, that is a belief and a conviction, you see. And some people take that very seriously and get really upset if you question that. You see, like one of the interesting things, Christians tend to have a fish, right? Well, now there's this, with Darwin, have you seen this?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So Christians have this with, because the Greeks, ichthus is fish in Greek. And if you, it's an acronym for Jesus Christ, Son of God. And it was a thing that the early Christians used to put down to communicate with each other secretly. You see, he could just draw a fish on the ground and you would understand. So it became a symbol. It's not from Jesus. In fact, some people say it's actually out of Babylonian mystery religion that the fish was a symbol of eternal life. So this counters this. In other words, he's telling you, this is what I believe. I don't buy that hogwash. This is my faith. You see? Well, it's evolution, right?
Yeah,
that's right. That fish, and then we went to the amphibious stage, and then to whatever stages there are So that's what religion does. It serves as a model. Now, what happened in the 7th century, right, there was a lot of religious chaos in the world. And the Christians, they had kind of dealt with most of these problems, usually through one of the interesting things that happens to these models is that authority co-opts them. It's like, in the 1960s, rock music was a counterculture. It was a way of making a statement. You got out and blasted out this, for some people, cacophonic sound, just disharmonious and distorted and really bothered a lot of people. But for some people, it was like this statement, right, of, I am rebelling against Frank Sinatra, or whoever they wanted to rebel against. And so what happened is now Pepsi Cola sells more cola with Michael Jackson, who's a pop star. So the
authority or the dominant culture co-opts this kind of, and this is what happens to religion a lot. It's very interesting to watch this happen historically. And Islam has certainly not been immune to that,
as all of the other religions haven't either. So what happened is that there was a lot of chaos. Now, in the Arabian Peninsula, these people were really what we would consider pretty frightening characters. They did things like bury female children alive. Now, we can say, that's horrific. Thank God we're in the 21st century or on the verge of it, and things like that don't happen anymore. And then we open up the San Francisco Chronicle, female infanticide increases in India and China, because it's still going on today. Now people go and get ultrasounds to find out if they've got a girl in there so they can get it sucked out with a vacuum in India. I mean, that actually happened. Why? Because males are very important. Females aren't. You see, that's what it's telling us, really. I mean, that act. And this is what the Arabs were saying when they did that. And so that can tell us a lot about what the Arabs were about. If they could go out and bury their own child alive because it was a female and they were embarrassed about it, because the firstborn had to be a male, because that proved that you were a man. So they worshipped idols, and literal idols, not like kind of idols in the head. They worshipped idols made out of wood, made out of dates. One of the people who became Muslim later said, you know, I can't believe how stupid I was. We used to worship idols made of dates, and when we got hungry, we would eat them. You know. And one man who became a Muslim, every house had an idol. And he went into his house, and there was a fox urinating on the head of his idol. And he said, what kind of God is it that a fox can pee on its head? And at that point, he kind of realized that it was pretty irrational to worship things like that. And so what happens is the Prophet Muhammad grows up in this environment, and he's seeing these things around him, and they really bother him. But he doesn't articulate anything. He doesn't really speak out against it. And the reason that the Quran gives is because he really didn't know what to say about it. And that's what it says. He wasn't clear about it, because that had to do with this thing. What does all this mean? Because we have to ask those questions in this society now, because a lot of things don't work for us anymore. See, for a lot of people, Christianity doesn't work as a model. It just doesn't. There's a lot of people out there that don't buy it. For a lot of people, humanism doesn't work as a model, or whatever model we want to look at. And so, at the age of, and he was by his nature, a contemplative person who thought a lot. He used to go to a mountain near Mecca, and he would meditate during the lunar month of Ramadan. And at the age of, he was born in an aristocratic family from a poor branch of the dominant tribe of Saudi Arabia, which was called the Quraysh. And sometimes you see that with a K-O, Quraysh. And the Quraysh were, they were merchants, and they were also caretakers of a house that was called the Kaaba. Or sometimes it's stuff like this. And Kaaba comes from a word that means cube. And it's a black house. And it's made out of stones. And it's, according to tradition, it was built by Abraham and his son Ishmael. And Hagar, right, who was the maidservant of Sarah, who she gives to Abraham because she can't have children at that point. It's not the bastard son, because in their tradition, it was permissible for a male to produce offspring from a servant, a maidservant. That was actually part of their law. And so he had a child named Ishmael from that marriage. And then Sarah, according to biblical tradition, became jealous. And so he takes Hagar to, or Hagar, they call him, takes her to the valley of Becca, or Mecca, and leaves her there. Now, according to the Islamic tradition, he was commanded to do that. And what happens is she gets very anxious and starts running between two small hills there. And she finds a spring, which is called Zemzem. And the house, Abraham comes back and builds this house. And it is the first house that was built for the worship, because Abraham was a nomad, actually. He was in tents. And it's the first house, according to the Islamic tradition, that was built for the worship of one God only. No idols. One God. Now, although Abraham is the progenitor, he's the father of the Jewish race, he's also the father of the Arab race. And so he's not neither Jew nor Christian. In fact, the Quran says that. He's not a Jew. Because the Jews come from Judah, who is one of his sons. In the same way the Arabs come from Ishmael, who is one of his sons. So he built this house, and what happens is, and this is what the Quran says, and this is a very important point that the Quran constantly makes, is that as time passes, things change. Like we saw rock music at a certain point with a cultural rebellion, it becomes part of the culture, and it becomes accepted. You see, whereas initially it was counterculture and really kind of unaccepted. And so in the same way, things change and they're adopted. So what happened is people, according to the Quran, people have a tendency toward idols. They have a tendency to make things that are abstract material so that they're tangible, they're graspable, they're touchable. I mean, the first thing that a child does is it just puts everything in the mouth. Right? That's what it does. Because it needs to experience things through the senses. And that's the way it understands the world. So it literally is out there grasping the world. And so what we tend to do in order, in fact, with people, give me a concrete example. Like when people are talking, give me an example. In other words, you want something that is similar to it. And that's what we call metaphors and similes. And those are the way we understand things. Right? That's the way we grasp things, is through what's it like. Because if you don't know something, you want it to be like something else in order for you to grasp it or understand it. Now, God is an extremely abstract concept. God. Infinity. What does that mean? Infinity. To define something, right? The word define literally means to give it finiteness. Right? To give it limits. That's what it means, to limit it, to make it finite. Now, something that's infinite, how do you make it finite? Well, the Quran says you can't. And Kierkegaard comes to the same conclusion about 1380 years later, that you can't define God. You can't make a model out of God. So what do we do then? Well, what happened is that... What the Quran says to do is don't try. And that's why the fundamental teaching of Islam is what's called. Does anybody have any idea what it would be? Anybody? You want to take a stab at it? This is an Arabic word, tawheed, which means unity. And what the Quran's fundamental message is that God is one, but there's no thing like Him. Even when we say Him is, according to the Islamic teaching, linguistic expediency. God is not a father, God is not a son, God is not a goddess, God is not a male or a female, God is not a form, God is not a substance. God is not a being. according to the Muslims. Now, you might read in books Supreme Being, right? That is not a correct definition according to the Muslim theologians. God is not a being, because being is stuff we know. This is being. Right? All this stuff that we're in. And we are being. We're all part of it. God is none of those things. Now, in Greek logic, they have this thing called the excluded middle. That either something is this or it's that, but it can't be both things at the same time. Well, the Buddhists have a whole other logic that says things can be the same thing at the same time. Why not? And that is closer to the Islamic logic. Because the Muslims say God is neither part of his creation, nor is he separate from it. And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, we don't understand that. I mean, the intellect at a certain point kind of like tilts in those pinball games. It tilts. And you have to wait for it to come back to its senses. And so this understanding of God. Now, some people say that's a very impersonal understanding of God. In other words, in Christianity, really one of the fundamental things is that we have a deeply personal relationship with God through the Son. In fact, God so wanted to know man that he became man. And we could actually see him and look at him. Right? And that's very tangible, very graspable. But the Muslims, and according to the Islamic teaching, say it's a nice idea that it's the same as this thing. That's what they say. And so it's idolatry in the Islamic religion. It's idolatry to say that any human being is divine. We are from the divine, but we are not the divine. We are the divine's creation. And Jesus, according to the Muslims, was created. He was created.
He made by whom?
By God.
By God.
By God. Yeah. And what I'm doing, because I know some of you are Christian, and I'm not in any way, the Quran says that everybody has the right to believe and understand God. I don't understand it, but I'm presenting to you what the Muslims understand, and it's not in any way to offend your faith or something like that. And I was a Christian before I was a Muslim. So, I actually delved quite deeply into the religion.
Am I right in saying that is Jesus an idol?
According to the Muslims.
According to the Muslims.
Yeah.
Okay.
To make him a god, to make him an object of worship is idolatry. Because again, idols are not wooden in the Muslim tradition. There are two types of idols mentioned in the Quran. One is an idol in the mind, which is called watan, and the other is an idol made out of material called sunam. There are actually two different words used in the Quran for idol. So democracy can be an idol. The American flag can be an idol. The 49ers can be an idol. Madonna can be an idol, you see. And people commit suicide when movie stars kill themselves or die. Have you read things like that in newspapers? I mean, why would somebody do that?
correct me if I'm wrong, but this perception I always had that a lot of the Muslims, at least how it's perpetrated in their country, worship Muhammad.
No. Absolutely not.
Well,
that's a major mistake. And one of the mistakes that comes out of that is what's called Muhammadism, which is not a name of Muslims. Muslims, Islam is a religion.
Islam is the religion. And Islam comes from the root word selima, which is the same word we get in Hebrew, which is because the sa sound in Arabic is sha in Hebrew. And so the Hebrews say shalima or shalom. Have you heard that, shalom? It's the same root word because they're Semitic languages. They're related to the same language group. And so what shalom or salima means is shalom means peace, and salam means peace. And when you say salam alaikum or shalom aleichem in Hebrew, what you're saying is peace be upon you. Now, peace is an interesting word. In Arabic, it's salah.
And what salam means, because it comes from this root, which means to be whole. To be whole. And so, for instance, when your body is whole, you're at peace. But if you've got a headache, you see, something's not whole there. You've got some element that's causing problem. And then you become, feel at ease. That peace goes, that sense of peace. War is the same thing. When you have conflict, you have war. So peace is a wholeness. So the word Islam means submission. And what submission is entering into peace with yourself. Submission is not surrender. It's not giving up. There's two different words in the Arabic language. And often it's translated as surrender. But it's not surrender. It's submission. And they're very different words.
What's the difference between faith and
like Farrakhan, black Muslim?
And they use the same, this is what the Quran, whatever that is.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that
assassination
of Islam?
Yeah, well,
just looking towards Elijah Muhammad.
Elijah Muhammad. They actually think that God came in the form of a man in 1926 named W.D. Farrakhan. And he, and Elijah Muhammad was his messenger. But from the Muslim point of view, it's a mythology. It's just made up. Yeah, that's the Muslim point of view.
It's
not even a cult.
I mean,
in the sense of, it's not even part of Islam. Do you see what I mean?
Do they use the same biblical? I mean, that's
awful. I think they mix the Quran. He uses the Quran, Farrakhan. I've listened and read his stuff. I mean, they believe that there was a scientist centuries ago named Yaqub who, that people were originally black, which is an interesting concept because in Arabic and Hebrew, the word Adam, it's Adam in Arabic. The word Adam means dark in Hebrew and Arabic. It's actually the color of, what's that?
Isn't Adam from the
time? No, Adam's the first man.
First man.
Yeah. And the word Eve, which is in Arabic, Hawa, means black. And it's interesting because biologically, blacks can produce white, but the reverse is not possible by our materialistic sciences. In other words, a black person through centuries, or even they can have, they can produce albinos. You can find albinos in the midst of African tribes that are as white as white. But, white people do not produce black people. It doesn't happen. And so, I think that is a very biologically sound premise to believe that the first people were dark. And that is linguistically the way the Quran talks about it. Udma, which is what Adam is from, means topsoil. But let me I just want to get to this thing here. So Islam means submission, and submission is about acceptance, not surrendering, acceptance. Now we are called slaves of Allah in the Quran. And the Quran says everybody is a slave, whether you like it or not, you're a slave. Now what that means is you're limited. You see, a slave by its nature is limited. It can't go certain places, it can't do things without permission. What the Quran says is that you're all limited. You see, you can't do a lot of things. You're not omnipotent, you're not omniscient, you're not all-powerful or all-knowing. Therefore, you're limited, which is an attribute of slavehood. But what it says is, there are rebellious slaves, and there are slaves in submission to their master. Right? Those are the two types. And slavery is a model for understanding it. This is a metaphor. Okay, it's just a linguistic model for understanding something. And so what the Quran says is that you are all slaves of God because He created you. And He is your master. And the master, according to one great theologian, Imam Nawawi, he said that it's as if God
he's got two slaves. And he tells them both to go to the marketplace. And the marketplace, and he tells them each to bring back something. Like he gives them both a dollar or $100 or whatever something costs. This is a metaphor. And he tells them to go and purchase something for him. And so the two go. Well, one of them is very determined. He doesn't look around, doesn't get caught up in what's called the vanity fair, right? Like a sideshow, like Pinocchio. Remember Pinocchio? Pinocchio is going to school, and then Foulfellow comes and says, no, you need a vacation. Come. And he takes him to Pleasure Island, right? And, well, what happens is, all of a sudden, wow, they're all turning into donkeys. And he says, I got to get out of here, because pleasure's not it. Right, and then he goes to become an actor, right? Fame. I mean, it's a very spiritual story, Pinocchio, because what does the fairy godmother tells him? If you want to be a real boy, in other words, if you want to be a real person, you have to be truthful, brave, and selfless, and those are very high spiritual qualities. And Pinocchio actually has to jump into the ocean of the unknown to look for his father, right? And then he becomes a real boy. And that's what religion's about, hopefully, is becoming real, becoming authentic, becoming conscious. And consciousness is about choice. And so that's where this whole idea of submission comes into. So he says that one of them goes, he's very determined, he comes back and brings this the thing that he was asked to do. The other one goes, and he's, wow! This is incredible. Look at this store. Look at this store. And he starts going in and checking. Oh, and this is, and goes in and all of a sudden it's nightfall and the marketplace is closing and he didn't buy that thing. And he's running around and he's looking for the store. It's too late. And that's death. You see, that's a metaphor for what the world is like. You see, and what that thing that he asked us to buy, which is really interesting. What that thing is knowledge of Him. That's the metaphor for it, is that we have to come to know God. Now, I said earlier, well, God's unknowable. That is knowledge of God. That He's unknowable, according to the Muslims. That is knowledge. And that is why the fundamental act of prayer in the Muslim teaching is to put your head on the ground. Because it's surrendering the intellect, which is not throwing the intellect away. In fact, you have to get with the intellect to that point, or else it's inauthentic or undifferentiated. In other words, the act of, you know, there's a scene in the gospel where it says Jesus in Matthew, it says Jesus threw his face on the ground. And then you'll find that in the Old Testament, but that's actually the way that they used to worship, put their head on the ground. And that is out of a sense of awe. You see. In fact, the Prophet Muhammad used to do that occasionally. Out of thanks or gratitude. They call it the prostration of gratitude, which somebody would come and give him good news and he would go into prostration at that instant. And so that is the act of surrendering, submitting the intellect to God. And at that point, when you're in prostration, the heart is over the intellect. The heart is physically over the intellect. You're elevating the heart over the intellect and saying that this is the point where I need to know my goal through my heart and not my intellect. So it's,
Are women allowed to pray like that?
Absolutely. They're not allowed. They have to.
Well, we only see in TV or in the news, we only see.
Yeah. Well, they're separate.
We don't see the women pray.
Yeah, they're separate. It's a good question. They're separate. And the reason is because the Prophet Muhammad was commanded to separate the women, and the understanding there is that men should not be behind a woman prostrating in front of him because, one, that is a sexual form. That is a way many people actually have sex. And you're not supposed to be distracted in the prayer. So that is Islam. Is submission. And so the Prophet Muhammad, in the midst of this society, at the age of 40, has this revelation. Now, some people have said, and this is something you can read still in books, is that, well, he just heard all these stories about the Jews and the Christians and kind of copied them all down and put them into this book called the Quran. You can actually still read these things in books written about Islam. And thank God, real researchers and theologians, people like Hans Kuhn, I mean, they're not using that argument anymore because it's not true. Whatever he had, whether you choose to believe it or not, it was a deeply religious experience, you see, whatever it was. Whether you accept it as revelation or not, uh-huh.
Well, who would be a perfect being?
We're going to get to that because that's part of the, we're going to get to that. That's part of the topic. This is about ritual. And so what happens at the age of 40, he actually has this revelation. And he's an unlettered man, and all he was known for before that point was that he was extremely trustworthy. He didn't speak a lot. He never recited poetry, which was very common amongst the Arabs. But he started spewing stuff at a lot, but started coming out with this language that really completely amazed the Arabs because they'd never heard anything like it. And it came forth from him, and people began to accept his faith. Now, initially, people really came down hard on him because he was challenging all of these assumptions, all of these idols. He was saying, don't bow down to wooden idols. That is not God. Now, he was challenging people's beliefs. And when people's beliefs are challenged, they either react two ways. Like a rational person, which is unfortunately very rare, and I think Aristotle made a big blunder when he called the human being a rational animal. I think a definition like somebody that eats cooked food would have been more applicable, because people tend to be very irrational, especially when their beliefs are questioned. And so that's one way, is to look at it rationally and say, does this make sense? Maybe he's got a point here. Maybe I should listen to it. The other way is to blunden him over the head with a very heavy object, right? And just kind of end of argument. And that's usually what happens historically to people like Socrates, Boethius. I mean, it's just on and on. Malcolm X, you know. Let's not deal with what they have to say. Martin Luther King, let's not have to deal with this. This person is making us think, and thinking can be disturbing sometimes, so let's just kind of get rid of them so we can go back to listening to music or watching TV or whatever we're doing. And so this is what he does, and these people, most of them coming from the slaves, from the poor people, and from the women, start to follow him, and really he started to upset people. And so they start persecuting him, which is very common in historical patterns. You can see this in many histories of religion. And so, after 13 years of calling people to Islam, he migrates from Mecca to a place called Medina. And in Medina, these people accept him. And he's there for 10 years before his death. So a total of 23 years, the Quran is being revealed. It didn't just come down like that, because that is not the way people accept things. People change gradually, and so it was a gradual process. What they call cold turkey, very rare, very difficult. People tend to change gradually. And so this is what happened. Over a 23-year period, this Quran came down. The Quran is probably equivalent in size to the New Testament and half, again, about the size of it. It's not as big as the whole Bible. Okay, maybe two New Testaments. And there's two aspects it deals with. One is perception, how we see things. The first thing it tells us is that there's no God but God. And so that is the fundamental teaching of Islam. La ilaha illallah. There is no God, nothing worthy of worship except God. Uh-huh.
So was it Muhammad that wrote the
whole Quran? He didn't write it. He could not read or write.
Who wrote it?
It was written down by people. It was transmitted from him orally. And it was written down by scribes.
So it was
The whole thing was written during his lifetime.
I mean, it was the whole thing was transcribed by his words.
Yes, it came directly from him to the scribes. And the Quran, interestingly enough, is the only historical religious document. What that means is it was revealed in the full light of history. That there were actually, history was a very well-developed science by that time, as opposed to earlier tradition. The gospel, one of the really interesting things about the gospel is it's very hard to find out historically what happened, how we arrived with four gospels as opposed to one or as opposed to 12, because there were a lot of different gospels. And it really wasn't resolved until 325. That's 325 years after the birth of Christ, where things really kind of got settled out. Whereas, and the Hebrew Bible is even more difficult. They don't exist. I'm taking that on faith from the Bible. Nobody's ever seen the tablet. And Moses isn't even actually a historical character. He's a religious character. He's not a historical character. There's even some, and I believe in him. It's part of my tradition. But there are some people that don't believe in it. There's some people that don't believe Jesus ever existed, and they're actually, Robertson is a good example. John Robertson, who wrote Pagan Christ, he said it was a whole made-up thing, and that the Christians become the historian, so even Joseph, as he claims that the footnotes about Jesus were just kind of put in there by later Christians, that it was actually a whole mystery cult. And so that's not my point here. My point is that the Quran was revealed in the light of history. And it remains an unaltered book. There has nothing has been, not one letter has been taken out of it. And it has existed as an oral tradition until this day. The Quran is not taken from text. It is taken from people. It's been written down since the time of the Prophet only as a kind of a backup. Like you keep a computer disk, you have the hard drive, and then you keep a diskette in case something goes wrong with the hard drive, just to check it. But there are people all over the Muslim world who memorize the entire Quran, and they memorize it from somebody who memorized it, from somebody who memorized it, all the way back to the Prophet Muhammad. And it's not like the game we played in school where you tell her something, and by the time it gets to here, it's all different. It's rigorously been maintained. And it's always been checked with those original written scribes. So what happens then, the Quran has two aspects. The first is about perception, how you perceive things. And that is like a theory part of it. The other thing is how that theory comes into practice. And so the most important thing is that concept of unity of God. And that there has been an unbroken chain of prophets historically. The Prophet Muhammad, in a tradition, says that there were 124,000 prophets of God. Now, there's only 25 mentioned in the Quran. So that's a lot that aren't mentioned. And the Quran says we've told you some of their stories and others we haven't. So the Muslims believe that every single people, every ethnic group has had a prophet. But what happens is that as time passes, people change those writings, change the teachings, and then you begin to see the historicity of the religion. In other words, that kind of thrownness, how people put stuff onto the religion, and you get this cultural religion, you get all these different things, but that original pure teaching is gone. So you can't find it. And what it is, it's like seeing a car that's being used as a house. And if you know what a car is, you can kind of tell that, this was a car at one point, but it no longer functions. So that's the way the Muslims look at other religions. They accept them as valid manifestations of this divine communication between God and man. But they say that they don't function as they used to. Do you see? So there's truth there. There is truth there. And the Muslims say that categorically. There's truth in Christianity. There's truth in Judaism. There's truth in Buddhism. There's truth in all of these sacred manifestations. But it's not the whole picture anymore. That is the Muslim position. And that's what I'm telling you, you see. I'm not saying that you have to believe that, or that is the Muslim position, that is the position of the Qur'an. And so what the Prophet Muhammad is called in the Qur'an, the seal of the messengers. And he said that I am like the Prophet, and my relation to them is like a house that has been built and only one last brick needs to be put in. And I am that brick.
So he determined that himself? But
from the Islamic point of view, that was told to him.
Told to him by who?
By God. Through the emissary of Gabriel, the archangel Gabriel. That is the interface between the Prophet Muhammad and God.
So basically, I mean, that's still self-proclaimed.
Absolutely.
But through faith, it would be
things
in your religion. Yeah. So basically, it's thrown in words. You said that.
That's where the faith comes in. Either he's right or he's wrong. Right?
You use that word paradigm. Wouldn't the Quran be a paradigm or a model for that? And you say that that's not what they believe.
Okay. From the point of view, the paradigms can be turned over. From the Muslim point of view, and I'm talking from Muslim point of view, how the Muslim is viewing this thing, the Quran is not a paradigm because paradigms are models.
That is a model.
Well, the Muslims would say it's actually an articulation of reality.
I mean, it's just fanatic.
It's not. I'll give you an example. Newton said that we live in a mechanistic universe, right? That's the model he gave for us. And people believe that absolutely, wholeheartedly, that that was reality. That the world is like billiard balls. You hit one, get a reaction, cause and effect. Now, Heisenberg, right, who was a quantum physicist, comes along and Bohr and Einstein, and they blew a large part of Newton's worldview out of the water. Because all of a sudden they said, no, things don't work like that. There's this uncertainty principle. The subatomic world doesn't work like that. There's this randomness that we're perceiving. The things happen over here and they happen here at the same time without any apparent cause and effect. So Newton had a paradigm. He tried to make a universal paradigm that applies to everything, and it's not applicable to everything. It doesn't mean that there's not truth in it, because it does determine things at a very crude material level, but it doesn't explain everything. So that is a paradigm, and it was supplanted. It was another paradigm came that was superior to it. Now, who's to say that a brilliant genius beyond Einstein comes 20 years from now and says, no, they got it all wrong. This isn't indeterminacy. This isn't probability. And he gives us a mathematical model that supplants the model of Einstein. Do you see what I mean? So paradigms...
I mean, that's all subject to interpretation.
Exactly. No, that's a good point. That is subject to interpretation. But what I'm talking about...
I can't... In a way, you can't tell me that the Quran is not some type of model for people to look at or read. And to structure their lives based on that, such as the Bible is a Christian.
Right.
And that would be a paradigm.
It's a paradigm from that perspective. Right. But see, what I'm saying is that from the Islamic perspective, it is reality. It's not a model of reality. You see what I mean? Are you getting that?
Yeah, I get it.
Okay.
Because you're saying
that it can't be supplanted. From a Muslim point of view, it can't be turned upside down. For instance, from a Muslim point of view,
well, like the Holy Bible, the word holy means set apart.
It means what?
It means set apart. That's what holy means.
It also means full, complete.
So it means something like that in Islam.
The Quran says the Bible was a true revelation, and the gospel as well. But what the Quran says is that there's been alteration. So it's difficult to see now what is true and what's not. That is the Muslim point of view of the Bible. So,
go ahead.
So that is the point of view. So the difference simply is that from a Muslim perspective, a paradigm is a working model that as soon as a better one comes along, we can just throw it out. You see what I mean?
So as soon as a better paradigm
comes along.
So it is a paradigm, that's what you're saying.
Well, because that paradigm can be replaced by another one. But from the Muslim point of view, the Quran will not be replaced and cannot be replaced. Therefore, it's not a working model as long as, do you see what I mean? I'm talking from a believer's point of view. From your point of view, if you're not a Muslim, from your point of view, it's a model, and it would seem like semantics. In the same way that from a Christian point of view, Hind is not a model either. It's reality. Yeah. Now, there are a lot of people that their paradigms are their reality. There are other people that kind of step out and look at it and say, this is just a model. You see what I mean? Uh-huh.
About the Quran, that day I was reading something about Islam, and I'm not sure. There are four people after Muhammad.
Four rightly guided.
Was it
Kelly?
Kelly.
Uh-huh. And it's an English word now.
Yeah, I remember the first one. Actually, if he rewrite the Quran or he put them together,
right? He put them into one book, but they existed at that time, in scattered.
Oh, but then I found out they said, later on Islam got adopted by Turkey, right?
Uh-huh.
And they make it to be an official language, just take out all the old languages by the Arabic. Then
Arabic kind of became the official language of the Muslim world in the same way Latin was of Christianity. But the Turks actually spoke Turkish. They still do.
Yeah, and I don't know, different books written by different people. They're saying that actually they should have just take out all the traditions or anything matters with some Quran after they
No. There's been a lot of misapplication of Islam, just like there has Christianity, every religion. There's been misapplications of it.
So as you said, it's true from the point that they finished writing it first time to now.
Same book. Yeah, and there are four in existence today from that period that are written on parchment.
I'm kind of confused as to what was the belief? It's kind of ambiguous what the belief was before the Muhammad came along with the Quran.
Basically, idolaters. They worshipped idols.
Yeah.
And they didn't really have, there was no sophisticated belief system. There was no religion, state religion. You could worship anything. But they had main idols. Lath, Uzza, Hubal. They were main idols that they worshipped. But basically, it was idolatry. Very crude paganism.
So it didn't go in the path of
It was not a Judeo-Christian, no. There were
not Christian, I mean, but the Judeo. Did he go from the origin?
That's the way Western people look at it. They think and it is closer to Judaism than it is to Christianity in its outward form. In that there's a lot more rules, there's more laws.
So the Ten Commandments and all that, that doesn't mean...
Well, I mean, Ten Commandments sound good to anybody.
I mean, so you said that you believed in Moses.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I was just thinking, this might be a good time for a break.
Okay. Okay. Can I just finish one last thing and take just 3 minutes on it? And then when we come back, we could just maybe go into a discussion about this. But there are five basic pillars. Which is the foundation of Islam. The first one is the Unity Creed.
What did you call it? Pillars?
Pillars, yeah. The Unity Creed, which is? La ilaha illallah, which means literally, La is no, Ilaha is God. It would probably be a small in English. There's no capital letters in Arabic. And Illa is except. And this is Allah. And Allah it's like a proper name. God can be used for, Apollo was a Greek god. So God is a generic for anything divine. And then we have God with a capital G, which is Yahweh, or however you want to say it. In Arabic, Allah is the proper name. It's like my name is Hamza, my proper name. Whatever your names are, you each have proper names, and that's how, if I call you, you'll know. I can differentiate you through that. So I say, hey you, which could mean anybody in here. So that is the proper name. You can see it Semitically show up in the gospel, that according to the gospel, Christ is supposed to have said, Eloi, Eloi, lima, lima, sabachthani. Eloi is the same root word, Eloi. It means, because the Hebrews say Elohim, which means God. The Arabic is Ilah. They're very similar linguistically because they're from the same roots. And that's the first pillar. The second pillar is prayer, which is five times a day. And this is ritual, right? Outwardly, it's a ritual. I think of all the religions, Islam, to me, appears to have the least amount of ritual. And I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church, which had a lot of ritual, where there's no priesthood, there's nothing like that. So the prayer, and there are five prayers a day. And the first one begins at dawn. So, the next one is what's called zakat, and it's a purifying tax of your wealth that you give to poor people. And it's a poor tax. And it's roughly, for money, it's roughly 2.5% or 1/40 of your standing capital, not an income tax. In other words, 1 year has to pass. There's no income tax in Islam. It's actually forbidden by the Prophet. Income tax.
So
would
it be like a tithing?
It's a tithing. It's very similar to a tithing, yeah.
Who does it go to, like the government?
It goes to 8 people. No, you can do it individually. It goes to poor people, to homeless people, bereft people. It goes to slaves to free them if they're slaves. It goes to indebted people that have overwhelming debt that they can't pay. It goes to travelers, somebody traveling that doesn't have enough money to get home to where it came from. It goes to people that work to collect it, because there are organizations like Mercy International that collect it, kind of like the Red Cross, so they can use from that what they collect to sustain their growth as long as it's not exorbitant amount or, you know, it would be cheating or something.
What's
like
the
1/40 for? It's like 2.5%.
1/40 is 2.5%.
Uh-huh. And then the fourth one is fasting. And once a year, between sunrise, actually dawn, the first light, the sunset. Muslims don't eat, drink, nothing through the mouth, or have sex during the daylight hours. So there's a complete abstention.
Every day?
Every day for 30 days, 29 days.
Okay. Once a year?
That's once a year.
That's Ramadan.
Ramadan, right. And that is, during that time also, it's forbidden any time of the year to backbite, speak bad about people, but during this month, it's like a lot worse than it would be. It's kind of like a school for learning spiritual self-discipline. And I met a prisoner at Soledad who became Muslim, and he told me that he tried every religion, and he left it. And he said that the only religion that could cure his smoking was Islam, because when Ramadan came, you can't smoke during the day. So he just quit smoking and went 30 days. And never went back to smoking. So
everybody does it at the same time?
Everybody does it at the same time, unless you're sick or traveling. If you're sick, it's forbidden to fast. If it's going to harm you. If you're pregnant, it's forbidden to fast. If it's going to harm you, it is forbidden to fast. But if you're in good health, then you have to fast. And if you don't fast, it's considered kind of a grave
thing. Is it a special time of the year?
Yeah, Ramadan. The lunar month, it changes every year, 2 weeks forward. It's coming up in about 2 months.
Ramadan, how do you spell it?
Ramadan.
R-A-M-A-D-A-N.
cosmetic for the children?
Children are allowed to fast after the age of 7 if it's not harmful to them. And what most Muslim families do is they let them fast half the day, because children usually want to do it, because it's a very social event. People invite people over for dinner, so there's a lot of celebration during that time. You know, so children tend to. It's obligatory. All of these things are obligatory at the age of puberty.
I know, but you fast during the day, you eat in the evening, or you can take in water in the evening.
Oh, absolutely. No, once the sun goes down.
So like a 12-hour fast?
It depends on where you are. The Eskimos have a lot longer one than that. But
so
no, they can work it out with time.
So I have 12
it's
hours.
Usually about 12 hours if you're in a middle climate.
After 12 hours, you can just kind of just pig out?
Well, you're not supposed to, because pigs are kind of not really designed. You're actually supposed to kind of lessen your intake. Most Muslims end up starving out because they've kind of wandered from the spiritual discipline of the fast. So there's more food consumed in Ramadan in most Muslim countries than there is other times of the year. That's human nature, folks. That's where the reality comes face to face with the idea.
Can they have sex after the 12 hours?
Yeah.
So they can go back to their...
Yeah, and during the evening, yeah, that's fine.
Is that tradition? I mean, has it always been like that, or was it just a complete 30 days?
No, that's the way the Quran says.
It's always been like that.
Yeah. And the last thing is the Hajj. And the Hajj is the ultimate, breakdown or ripping away that thing I said earlier, the firmness, because all of a sudden you literally, I've made Hajj 3 times and everybody did, the whole of humanity, literally. Every single race on the earth is represented there, and it's mind-boggling. Hajj, which is the pilgrimage to Mecca. And that is, if you read it, the beautiful chapter in the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is about his journey to Mecca, that is what changed his life. And it's very powerful.
Okay, so what's the point of going
to Mecca? Only if you're able to. If you have the financial and the physical strength to go, you go, and it is a spiritual journey.
It's a
spiritual journey to your Lord. It's a metaphor for God. Catholics going to the Vatican. Very different experience. I've been to the Vatican. I just looked at all the gold. Anyway.